It's your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC for 20 great years has the best OTR on our live streaming. And continue tuning in to the Radio Book Channel, along with the RTC Music Channel. All at oldtimeradiolisten.com.
Welcome to the RTC Weekly Download, where we feature the best old-time radio available. And you can hear it here every week at around this time. Since it's a podcast, this time is whenever you collect it and play it. And since you're here, you're here. We're going to listen to two things. In about an hour's time, we'll have the Hollywood Star Playhouse with Vincent Price and Calculated Risk. But we'll start off with the NBC University Theater of the Air, Tales of Edgar Allan Poe from 1949.
This is the NBC University Theater, bringing you a full-hour dramatization of Tales of Edgar Allan Poe, starring Joseph Schildkraut. We bring you one of the most extraordinary men of letters ever to put pen to paper in America. And we bring you three tales from his pen. First, Nosology, followed by The Cask of Amontillado, and finally, The Fall of the House of Usher. The author, of course, is Edgar Allan Poe, whose feverish dreams inspired tales both awesome and beautiful, tales which won for him a unique place among the greats of American literature. Here now is Mr. Edgar Allan Poe.
Men have called me mad. Perhaps I am. It has never been settled, really, whether madness is or is not the loftiest intelligence. Let it be assumed, therefore, that I, Edgar Allan Poe, am mad, and that I am about to entertain you with three products of my imaginative but eccentric mind. The first of these, a curtain raiser, I will entitle only A Comic Mask. Mr. Conductor, if you please, some comic music.
My name is Jones. Yes, that's right, Robert Jones. I am, that is to say, I was, a great man. I was born at a rather tender age in the city of Fumfudge, latitude 600, longitude 066. Perhaps you've heard of me? No? Oh, what a pity. Very well, I'll tell you about myself. When I was born, my first act in life was to take hold of my nose with both hands and pull vigorously, thus. This caused my mother, who naturally was present at my birth, to remark to my father,
Robert, look, our boy is a genius.
My dear, I weep for joy. Believe me, I weep for joy.
Before I was 5 years old, I had chosen my career in life, namely, nosology. I pursued it avidly. Each morning, I gave my nose a strong pull. In the science of nosology, I soon came to understand that, provided a man had a nose sufficiently conspicuous, he might, by merely following it, arrive at a lionship, an honor much to be desired. My father, who had always been frustrated in his own ambition to become a successful mountebank, determined that I should achieve my goal. I remember distinctly how. Each evening, he would help me with my exercises.
One, two, three, tweak. One, two, three, tweak. One, two, three, tweak. Stop. Stop, my dear boy. Remember, these tweaking exercises give the nose plasticity, character.
Yes, Father.
Bear in mind, therefore, that the tweak must be vigorous and forthright. Thus.
Yes, Father.
Very well. We'll now practice turning up the nose contemptuously.
Now observe closely, my boy. Thus. One, two, turn up thusly. One, two, contemptuously. One, two.
Father! Father!
What is it, son?
Father, I've been...
Well, what's the trouble?
I'm sick! One day, when I had come of age, my father asked me if I would step into his study, and this I did. You wish to speak to me, Father?
My boy, it's time that you and I had a serious talk.
Yes, Father.
Now, first of all, tell me, what is the chief end of your existence?
Why, Father, to master the science of nosology.
That is correct, my boy. And now, can you tell me, what is the exact meaning of a nose?
The exact meaning. A nose, my father, has been variously defined by some 6,000 authorities. Let's see, it is now exactly 3 minutes before 12 noon. We shall have time to get through most of the definitions, I think, before midnight. To commence, then, father. The nose, according to Bartholinius, is that protuberance, that bump, that prow which precedes a man when he's giving himself into a lot of... When I had completed the last of the 6,000 definitions, my father drew me to his side and said...
My boy...
Yes, father?
Your education is finished.
Thank you, father.
It's time now for you to go out into the world and scuffle for yourself.
Yes, father.
Tell me, my boy, you know what you must do, of course.
Why, of course, father. I must always follow my nose.
Exactly, my boy. Exactly.
And so, giving my nose a pull or two right on the spot, I marched out into the streets of Fumfudge to seek my fortune. As I made my way up the main thoroughfare, astounded citizens pointed at me with admiration and respect.
Is it possible?
Unbelievable!
Mommy, look! A rhinoceros!
Who is he?
What is he?
Oh!
Ignoring these peasants, I blew my nose loudly. And continued on my way until I reached a fine-looking studio bearing a sign which read, Signor Tintintino, portrait painter to royalty, by appointment to the king and by rendezvous with the queen. I stepped inside, and there was the Duchess of Bableu sitting for a portrait. Behind her stood the Marquis, holding her pet poodle. At her side stood the Earl, supporting the Marquis. At an easel stood Signor Tintintino. I approached this great artist and slowly, very slowly turned up my nose.
Good.
Shocking.
What a nose, Signore. How much you take for this nose? I must paint this nose, Mamma Mia.
£1,000.
£1,000? Madre, turn to the light. Eh?
With pleasure.
Oh, I simply must touch it.
Carefully, madam. This is really a very valuable piece.
you show she's quite original.
My dear Signor Tintintino, I assure you that I've raised this nose from a tiny little nostril.
Admirable. I give you £100.
Sorry, 1,000.
200.
Sorry, 1,000.
600.
Sorry, 1,000.
9.
Sorry, 1,000.
Very well.
Good.
She's done. £1,000, and I'm gonna paint her this very morning.
This was indeed a stroke of genius. In a week's time, Signor Tintintino's portrait of my nose was hung in the Royal Academy. Overnight, I became a celebrity. I wrote a pamphlet on nosology, and I sent the Queen a first edition, enclosing a reproduction of Tintintino's masterpiece. Why, the Prince of Wales invited me to dinner, and what a dinner! The people who were there, why, every one of them a lion, a giant among men. As guest of honor, I, of course, was introduced around by the Prince.
Sir P. Peridot.
Your Highness.
I should like you to meet Mr. Jones.
Not the Mr. Jones, the author of Noses That Made History.
Yes, sir, the same.
I am honored, sir. You are a man who knows his noses.
Thank you.
Sir P. is being modest. He happens to be a modern Platonist and a lion among men. He's also a lion among women.
charming fellow, but practically no nose, your princeship, no nose.
Here's another chap I should like you to meet.
Why, gladly.
Sir Delphinius Polyglot. Sir Delphinius?
Your Highness.
I should like you to meet...
Don't tell me. Let me guess. Pinocchio.
Droll fellow.
Yes. And... Cyrano.
Hardly.
Why, then this must be the Mr. Jones.
It is. Yes, indeed, it was quite a dinner. Even Signor Tintintino was there. He discoursed upon Latour and Chambertin. The president of Thunfud University made a speech. The eminent archaeologist Ferdinand Futzelfutzelspar spoke briefly for several hours on internal fires and tertiary formations and things like that. And finally, of course, it was my turn to speak, my topic. You guessed it. I merely turned up my nose and I spoke of myself.
Marvelous.
Thank you.
Clever man.
Superb, absolutely superb.
Thank you. The very next morning, Her Grace the Duchess paid me a visit in my apartments. Somewhat plump, but a charming little woman, my heart went out to her at once.
You darling creature. I know you must simply be thronged with admirers. But I said to myself, I simply must meet this fabulous man. And here I am.
Why, I'm honored, Your Grace.
Don't you think it was rather daring of me to come to your apartments unescorted? But then, I've always been one to seize the bull by the nose.
And I have always admired a certain measure of boldness in women, Your Grace.
Oh, charming man. You simply must attend the ball I'm giving tomorrow night. You will come, pretty creature.
Ball? I'm sorry, I had promised the Queen.
The Elector of Bludenoff will be there.
The Elector of... I'm not familiar.
Not familiar with the Elector of Bludenoff?
Why, no.
Why, my dear man, he is said to have the largest nose in all the world.
Oh, Your Grace.
In Europe, at any rate.
Certainly not in England, madame. Please, observe.
I'll admit it does look rather long.
But it is rather long.
Of course. If you come, we can compare your nose with the Elector's and settle the controversy once and for all.
Your Grace, I shall be there.
You definitely will come.
Why, Your Grace, with all my heart.
Oh, no, Mr. Jones. With all your nose.
Yes, with all my nose. I had heard of this fellow, there's blood enough. A pretentious boor from the Low Country. Well, next night excitement ran high. At the Duchess's, the rooms were crowded to suffocation. Wagers were placed, duels challenged.
£1,000 on blood enough, by a nose.
Taken in double.
I say Jones by 10 millimeters.
Blood enough.
Jones!
Ladies and gentlemen, may I present our distinguished guest from the Low Country, the Elector of Bludenoff. And now, the British contender, our own Mr. Jones.
Look, she's going to introduce him.
Mr. Jones, the Elector of Bludenoff.
You call that a nose? Pah!
Gentlemen, please.
Your Grace, I sincerely regret this incident, but the mosquito bite which this gentleman dignifies by the title of nose offends me.
Tausend Teufels!
Sir, may I tell you that you're a baboon?
Donald Blitzen!
That, sir, I will not countenance. Have at you!
Oh!
My second will call upon you in the morning, sir. There simply was no other way. His nose, alack and alas, was bigger than mine. Very well, we met next morning upon the field of honor. Our weapons, pistols at 30 paces. We faced each other. I gave my pride a twist and sounded my klaxon contemptuously. He blew his. A pitiful little blow, and the referee counted off the paces.
28, 29,
30. Fire! Parbleu, the deed was done. I had shut off his nose. Now there was no one in the entire world with a nose equal my own. Ah, my pride, my joy of a nose. I returned to the palace and discovered that a reception had been prepared. Evidently, news of my victory over Bloodenough had preceded me. I entered and approached the Duchess, but when I reached to kiss her hand, alas, she snubbed me. That's all she said. Your Grace, I don't understand.
There is nothing to understand, Mr. Jones.
But haven't you heard, Your Grace? I won the duel. I shut the Elector's nose right off his face.
Your presence is no longer required.
Well, won't somebody explain you, sir, what...
Dolt.
Perhaps you, sir.
Noodle.
But this reception, gentlemen, for whom has it been prepared?
For whom, sir?
Yes.
For whom but the Elector of Bloodenough?
What? I was baffled. Nay, I was chagrined. My nose wilted. Yet the facts were there. I had won. I was the uncontested nose champion of the entire world. Yet a reception of honor had been prepared for my defeated adversary, the Elector of Bloodenough. Shunned, scorned, carrying my proboscis at a deflected 45-degree angle, I slunk from the court. I appealed to my friend the prince, but all he said was... That's all he said. Things went from bad to worse. My pamphlet on nosology no longer supported me. My portrait was sent back from the royal galleries, and finally, in utter defeat, I return home to live with Papa. I am home, Father.
Yes, my son.
Father, I am a failure in nosology.
I know, my son.
But why, Father? Why?
Sit down, my boy.
Yes.
That's better. My son.
Yes, Father.
You have learned a sad truth about life.
Yes, but what truth, Father?
You've learned that a man with a nose more conspicuous than others can be a lion among men until he overshoots his mark, as you have overshot yours.
Yes, but how, Father?
My boy, all men have noses, but the Elector of Bloodenough has no nose at all. And with such, there's no competing.
Oh!
Surely men accuse me unjustly of being macabre and morbid. I have a delightful sense of humor. If you don't believe me, just listen to another of my tales. This one I have entitled, The Cask of Amontillado.
On the coat of arms of my family, the Montresors, is graven Nemo me impune lacesit, meaning no one harms me with impunity. The coat of arms itself is a huge human foot done in gold against the field of Asia Blue. The foot crushes a serpent whose fangs are embedded in its heel. I tell you this only so you will understand why I had to act as I did. And while I'm telling you about it, have a drink. A drink of Amontillado, the real thing, too. I know. I know because I have the word of that connoisseur of wine, Signor Fortunato. My old friend Fortunato. The thousand injuries of this Fortunato I had borne as best I could through the years, but when he ventured on insults, I vowed revenge. It was at the height of the carnival season in Venice when I saw him in the crowd, dressed in the costume of a jester. I was genuinely pleased to see him. Hey, Fortunato? Fortunato! I beg your pardon, sir. Hey, Fortunato!
Montresor!
Well, 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 my dear friend, I am glad to see you.
Oh, how goes it, Montresor?
Excellently well.
Oh, I'm having a most wonderful time. I'm in my second childhood, but I haven't seen you in weeks. I was afraid you were avoiding me.
Avoiding you? Never.
Good, good.
Oh, but, my friend, you are luckily met. Oh, come over here in this doorway out of the crowd.
Very well. What's on your mind?
Listen, Fortunato. Only today I have received a barrel of what passes for Amontillado wine.
Not really.
Well, I have some doubts.
Amontillado?
Well, as I say, I have some doubts.
Amontillado. Oh, when did I last taste Amontillado?
But I see you are having a little vacation, and therefore I will go to Lucchese. If anyone can tell a good vintage, it certainly is Lucchese.
Lucchese. Lucchese has the nose of a pig. Come. Let us go.
Go? Go where?
To your wine vaults.
Oh, no, my friend. I couldn't possibly impose.
Oh, I insist.
No, the vaults are damp and you have a bad cough.
I will not be swayed.
But the vaults are very deep.
Your arm, sir.
You insist?
I insist.
Very well, my friend. Let us go to the vaults of Montresor. Careful, careful, my friend. These steps are rather slippery.
Your vaults are very deep.
Tell me, how long have you been troubled by that bad cough?
Oh, it's nothing.
Perhaps we should turn back.
I won't hear of it.
No, I really feel we should. You must be careful. You're a man to be missed, after all. Are you not rich and respected, beloved?
By some, my wife.
You see, for me it wouldn't really matter, but for you, no. I shall engage Lucchese.
Enough. I shall not die of a little cough.
Well, if you will not be deterred, at least let me offer you a drink of Medoc. Here, we will select one of these bottles. Look at that dust. 50 years old. Here, drink, my friend.
Good. Will you not join me?
Very well. I drink to those who are buried here.
Buried?
Oh, yes, my ancestors used these vaults as a dungeon.
Oh, I see.
To your long life, my friend. Now come, let us proceed to the Amontillado.
One moment.
Yes?
Do I hear water?
Yes, we are under the river now. Why, is the moisture perhaps too much for your cough?
I shall survive. Montresor.
Yes, what?
What? What is that? Hanging, swinging slowly to and fro in the passageway ahead.
Oh, that? Nothing, just a skeleton.
A skeleton?
Yes, my ancestors, you see, very vengeful people. Careful now, careful, don't bump against it.
Is it much further to the Amontillado?
Just a few steps. Bad cough. Come, through the archway ahead. Here we are.
This chamber?
Mm-hmm.
I see no Amontillado.
Patience, you shall, my friend. But first, permit me to point out the interesting architectural structure of this cell. As you see, it is circular, completely circular, with a very narrow doorway.
Yes, the Amontillado.
Yes, the Amontillado, in a second. And over there are chains stapled to the wall to fasten about the waist of the victims. Let me show you. Step over here, please.
Montresor, this is all very interesting, but...
Just a moment. Stand still. Thus.
Very interesting. But now, if you will remove them.
Of course, my friend. Of course, I was merely demonstrating.
Of course.
Strange. This key here seems stuck in the lock.
Well, perhaps I can work it.
Wouldn't it be funny, my friend, if I had to get a locksmith now to saw you loose?
Montresor, for heaven's sake.
Now, don't worry. Here, why don't you have another drink of this Medoc?
No, the Amontillado.
Oh, yes, I forgot, of course. The Amontillado, of course. I'll fetch it. Wait, it's right out here. There. Taste it and drink. Well?
It is! Amontillado!
Amontillado, drink up.
now. Have some more. Have some more.
No, really.
Nonsense. One more sip.
Perhaps one.
That's better.
Oh, it makes the head go round and round, Amontillado.
Doesn't it? Nothing like one last drink.
Last drink?
Before we leave.
Oh, but these chains I'm wearing.
Yes, I know. I'd forgotten.
Wouldn't it be funny if I had to stay here the rest of my life and drink up all of your Amontillado?
Very funny indeed. Tell me, you don't mind if I do some work while you drink, eh?
No. Go ahead.
Thank you.
What are you doing kneeling in the doorway, Montresor?
Oh, I'm just mixing up some mortar.
Like baking a cake.
That's right, like baking a cake.
When do you suppose I'll get these chains off?
Soon, my friend, soon.
No hurry. Nothing I like better than to sit here and drink Amontillado and watch you work. What you doing now?
Now, my friend, I am practicing the art of the mason.
Isn't that funny? I could swear you were laying bricks. Laying a row of bricks across the doorway. And I'll have to step over them when I leave. Whoops. Oh, my cup is empty.
Empty? Well, wait, I'll get you some more.
Oh, gotcha, amico.
Yeah.
Montresor?
Yes, my friend?
Tell me, why do you build a wall of bricks in the doorway?
To protect you, my friend.
Oh, but if you build a wall of bricks, how am I going to get out?
That is exactly the point, Fortunato. You are not going to get out.
Montresor!
You see, it's quite simple. In a little while, these bricks will come up to your waist, and then to your chest, and then to your eyes, and then...
Please, Montresor. I want to get out of here.
No.
Montresor!
Oh, nonsense. Drink, my friend. It'll do your cough good. Drink!
Oh, a very good joke, Montresor.
Isn't it?
Excellent joke. Oh, we shall have many a rich laugh about it at the Palazzo over our wine.
Naturally, Amontillado.
Oh,
course,
yes.
Amontillado.
But come, Montresor. Stop playing with those bricks and remove these chains from me.
Which chains?
Come, let us be gone.
Yes, right. Let us be gone.
For the love of God, Montresor!
Yes, for the love of God!
Montresor!
Fortunato? Hey, Fortunato! Speak. You mustn't be dead yet. You mustn't speak. Don't cheat me like that. You couldn't cheat me like that. You couldn't cheat me like that. You couldn't cheat me like that.
From Hollywood, the NBC University Theater is bringing you Joseph Schildkraut in a radio version of Three Tales by Edgar Allan Poe. Today's broadcast is part of a series devoted to the classic works of Anglo-American literature. If you're interested in supplementing your enjoyment of these productions with home study under college supervision, be sure to listen to the announcement at the close of this program. And now, our intermission commentator, Dr. Harvey Webster, Associate Professor of English at the University of Louisville. Speaking from Louisville, Kentucky, here is Dr. Harvey Webster.
It is the peculiar misfortune of America's first great writer of fiction that he has been reprinted, retaught, and reread so often, and is mediocre or worst, that few people of intelligence continue to take him seriously after they escape from high school or college. Somehow, Poe's name gets associated with the obvious horror of the Telltale Heart, with his too many, too unconvincing followers in pulp magazines, with an unhappy, thoroughly neurotic life. This is natural, unfortunate, and wrong, for Poe, at his very frequent and very frequently ignored best, has communicated some experiences more vividly than any other writer of English. His best stories, I believe, are those in which he communicates the pleasure of thinking, of, to quote, that moral activity which disentangles. It is beautiful to watch the minds his mind controls at work. Remember Monsieur Dupin's thoroughly logical explanation of how he knew his friend's unspoken thoughts. Legrand's methodical ingenuity in solving the cipher in the gold bug. The clever quickness with which the old man saved himself from the maelstrom. Anyone that enjoys mental activity has liked or will like these stories. Next best, perhaps quite as good, are Poe's stories of psychological horror. In these two, the moral activity that disentangles is important, though here the disentangling is of abnormal mental states that are, after all, only exaggerations of what we consider normal. To a greater or lesser degree, we all know the second William Wilson. We have all felt something of the fascination with death and decay that becomes Roderick Usher. We have all been attacked by that imp of the perverse that propels the main characters of The Black Cat to self-destruction. Poe shows what Freud has demonstrated. The abnormal is the normal magnified. Poe's great accomplishment within a limited area makes us forget his faults and imitators. By a curious law of compensation, what was his misery is our gain. His great powers of intellect survive in spite of or because of his suffering in one of the most distinguished and uneven bodies of work that has been left by a writer of the first order.
Our radio version of Three Tales by Edgar Allan Poe, starring Joseph Schildkraut, will continue from Hollywood after a brief pause for station identification.
Edgar Allan Poe have found life a long and weird catalogue of miseries from which to select my themes. And of all these, the most awful, perhaps, is to be buried alive. Now, don't deny it happens. The boundaries which divide life from death are at best shadowy. Let me tell you a tale about such an interment. I call it The Fall of the House of Usher.
The day was dark and soundless, and black clouds hung oppressively low in the heavens. Toward evening, I caught a glimpse of something in the distance, and I spurred my horse toward it. As we approached, I could make out the hideous outlines of the House of Usher. The house was old, the masonry crumbling. It was built on a rock in the center of a deep tarn or pool of stagnant, rank water. Over all, there hung the atmosphere of a neglected vault of the gloom of the dead. I dismounted from my horse and walked across the wooden bridge that led to the great door. I felt a vague terror rising inside me, a desire to turn back and ride away. As I fought the urge, I found myself reaching into the breast pocket of my coat where lay the letter. The letter which had brought me to the House of Usher.
My dear Hugh, this letter will be brief and perhaps somewhat confusing to you because I write from the depths of an upsetting illness. Whatever its merits, please, in the name of our former friendship, Do not ignore its plea. I must see you, Hugh, as soon as possible. You are the only friend I can trust in this, my hour of need. I enclose a map directing you to the house of Usher. Your very dear friend, Roderick Usher.
And so I stood now before the huge door of the home of Usher. As I released the knocker, my eye caught a barely perceptible fissure, a crack, which extended from the roof down the wall in zigzag fashion to become lost in the sullen waters of the tarn.
Yes?
This is the house of Usher, is it not?
Who asks?
Sir Hugh Catlin, a friend of Sir Roderick Usher.
Come in, please.
Thank you. My horse
will
is...
be taken care of.
Oh, thank you. Good heavens, is the whole house as dark as this?
Sir Roderick prefers the darkness, sir.
Well, that's strange. As I recall, he always detested the dark.
Yes, sir. This way, sir. You'll be so good as to wait in this hall, sir.
Oh, thank...
I'll tell Sir Roderick.
Thank you. I stood outside a dark, carved door at one end of a long hallway. In the semi-darkness, as I stood there, waiting, I felt eyes upon me. And then, as my own eyes grew accustomed to the dimness, I saw, standing only a few yards from me, a young woman in a white, gauze-like gown. For a long moment, we stared at each other. And then, before I could speak, she turned and left, singing as she went.
I saw thee on thy bridal day, when a burning blush came o'er thee. Though happiness around thee lay, the world all love.
Sir Roderick will see you, sir.
Oh, thank you. By the way, is Sir Roderick married now?
Oh, no, sir.
Is anyone living here beside himself?
Perhaps you'd better let him answer that, sir. This way.
Welcome. Welcome to the house of Usher, Hugh. You're looking well, almost 13 years, isn't it? How are you?
I'm fine, Usher. How are you?
As you see me. Come. Here, sit down beside me. Well, what do you think of my ancestral hall?
Beautiful, but rather dismal with all these hangings and thick carpets. Do you mind if I turn up the
lamp? Don't touch that lamp, please.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Forgive me. Forgive me, I have been suffering with an affliction of the eyes recently. A single ray of light burns my eyes like the noon sun.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear it. That explains the darkness, of course.
And will you have a glass of sherry?
Oh, yes, thank you.
Here.
What, you drink with me?
I'd rather not.
Oh. That's good.
Well, how do you find me, Hugh? Am I not well-preserved, still rather handsome?
Yes, time seems to have treated you very well, Usher. I find you...
Yes? You were about to say?
Nothing.
Yes, you were about to say you find me altered. Come, come.
Yes, I was.
How?
Different, somehow.
Different how?
Agitated, unnerved.
So, I tried so very hard to conceal it. I told myself I will act very casual and normal. When he comes here, he'll never sense it.
What are you hiding, Usher? Your letter mentioned an illness.
Oh, nothing, just a slight nervous affliction. It'll pass over.
Why did you send for me?
Because you are the only person I could turn to, the only one who would understand.
Understand what?
Hugh, do you recall discussions we had once concerning euthanasia?
Mercy killing? Yes?
Exactly, yes. We spoke of it in school. You always said you were not morally opposed to it in extreme cases. Are you still of that opinion?
Why do you ask?
Can you not guess?
No.
Look at me, Hugh, please. Can you not see what's happened to me?
Only that you seem highly agitated.
Man, friend, are you blind? Can't you see I'm going mad?
Oh, nonsense.
Oh, no, not nonsense. This is a family affliction. I watched it destroy my father.
Fear of lights?
Not just light, my friend. Everything. Everything. All my senses have become unbearably acute. You see, the most insipid food, for instance, grates on my taste. A small little sound like the drop of water is thunder in my ears. My skin will tolerate nothing but the softest of silks. Odors. Oh, flowers. Flowers suffocate me. The closing of the door. Music. Why, you know how I love music.
I remember you played the organ, and very well.
Well, the only musical sound I can possibly tolerate is this lute here, tuned very softly.
You've been like this very long?
So long I can scarcely remember when I first drew these curtains to shut out the light, or when I first hung these drapes to deaden the sound.
Usher, when were you last outside this house?
I have not set foot outside this house or seen daylight, my friend, for 13 years.
Good heavens, man. What you need is to breathe fresh air and see daylight.
Oh.
This morbid atmosphere is enough to induce melancholy in a clown. It's like living in a tomb. I'm sorry. I know your problems will not be solved so easily.
What would you say of a man who cannot take a step outside his own house?
I'd say he was...
All right, say it, say it. Insane, insane, say it.
Usher, there must be some cure for
this. Yes, one.
What?
Death.
Death? No. Oh,
remember your philosophy.
You've thought of suicide.
I haven't the strength. I'm even afraid of that. And that's why I asked you to come.
I don't... understand.
I think you do. I asked you here because of your views on euthanasia.
You're not asking me to kill you.
Exactly.
You're mad.
I admit that.
You're worse than mad.
You, if there's an ounce of pity...
Usher, listen to me. This desire, this need to destroy yourself is caused by something. Perhaps it's something you've done. You wince at that. Tell me, let me help you.
Too late.
It's never too late. Confession will be the first step in your cure.
You really want to know?
I do.
You do. Very well. Then follow me.
Where do you take
me? To the tower wing. It isn't far.
What's there?
There. There, my friend, is the curse. The curse and the blessing of Sir Roderick Usher. Here. Madeline.
Who is it?
Dear, I want you to meet someone.
There is no one to meet.
Come here, dear.
No.
Please, Madeline, it's all right, really. Hugh, this is the Lady Madeline.
How do you do?
They're prettier in springtime.
I beg your pardon?
My violets. They've shrunk. It's the darkness. Darkness always kills living things. Do you find it so in Eulalium?
Well, yes. Yes, I do.
Oh, good. Then I'll sing you a song.
By all means.
Would you like a purple one?
Oh, any color you say.
The blue ones last longer.
Yes.
Shall I sing for you?
Do.
I saw thee once on thy bridal day.
Oh, come, Hugh, come.
When a burning glow.
Well?
Who is she?
Isn't she lovely?
She's mad. Is this house filled with nothing but madness?
I told you we are cursed from birth.
She's your wife?
No. My sister.
I see.
Do you?
I think I do. How long has she been thus?
It came upon her gradually. Please come, let us go down.
Yes.
You see, Hugh, when I went away to school, she was just a delightful little golden-haired child. Why, she worshipped me always. When I returned, she was a
woman and I was a man. Hugh, I swear to you our relationship was innocent, and yet that strange love between... Oh, God, God, forgive me.
Control yourself.
For 7 years, 7 long years, I've watched her becoming progressively worse, and then my own affliction began.
Where there's no sin, there should be no guilt.
Tell me, Hugh, is it possible that a man can suffer thus for an uncommitted sin?
Such things are not unknown.
Now you see why I turn to you.
But I am no doctor.
I don't want healing. I want punishment.
No. If men were punished for their evil thoughts, we would all turn on the rack. Oh. Usher, let me spend a few days here with you. We'll read and talk as we did in school. I remember your poetry was very exciting. Have you written anything lately?
No.
Well, then recite the old ones for me, and play for me. Come, we shall fight this melancholy, you and I, and together we shall triumph over it.
Thank you.
Bravo.
You really like it?
Oh, it's really very beautiful. You've improved, really.
Thank you.
Why do you stop?
Because I realize that I just now smiled for the first time in years.
You see, you're getting better already. Go on, though. Recite another.
Very well. You really want one?
Of course I do.
All right. I call this one here The Haunted Palace. In the greenest of our valleys, by good angels tenanted, once a fair and stately palace, radiant palace, reared its head. Banners yellow, glorious, golden on its roof did float and flow. This, all this, was in the olden time, long ago. But evil things in robes of sorrow assailed this fine estate. Oh, let us mourn, for never morrow shall dawn upon it desolate. And travelers now within that valley through red-litten windows see vast forms that move fantastically to a discordant melody, while like rapid ghostly river through the pale door a hideous throng rush out forever and laugh, but smile no more. No. Someone is coming.
Well, I hear nothing.
Yes, come in. Well?
Sir Roderick, you'd better come at once.
Come where?
The tower room, sir. It's the Lady Madeline.
Good. Madeline, what's wrong?
I don't know, sir, but you'd best hurry. I'm afraid something terrible has happened.
Well, Usher, why do you stand and stare?
She's dead.
What?
Dead.
But that's impossible. Why only a few days?
A cataleptic seizure. She's had them before. This time it was...
The floor has a strange ring.
Yes, it is sheathed in copper. This was once used as a storage room for powder. Please lower the coffin.
Very well.
Help me raise the lid.
Usher, in heaven's name.
One look, please, one look. Oh, isn't she lovely? See how, even in death, a faint rose tinges the cheeks. Farewell, sister. Beloved sister. Farewell, daughter of Usher. Fasten the lid.
Will you not pray?
I cannot pray.
Then I shall pray.
If you wish, but not for her.
For whom then?
For me, my friend. Please pray for me, that her image may never return to torture my poor brain.
For some days after the burial of the Lady Madeline, a change came over Roderick Usher. He roamed the padded halls of the House of Usher, his head to one side, as if in an attitude of listening. It seemed to me as if his mind were laboring under some horrible, oppressive secret which he was struggling to tell me. His attitude, his listening for some imaginary sound, began to infect me. I found myself doing the same. And as the days went by, I too succumbed to the somber influence of the House of Usher. It was on the eighth day after the entombment of the Lady Madeline. A storm had been brewing. That night I could not sleep. I was overpowered by a sense of impending horror. Then on my door there came a rapping. Who's there? Who is it? Speak up!
Hugh, I am afraid. I'm afraid as no man has ever been afraid before.
Usher, you've been living in this morbid house so long, you've become like it. So have I, almost.
Hugh, I hear something.
No, I hear nothing. Now you must relax.
Hugh, please read to me, will you? It may take my mind off the storm and off this house.
Of course it will. Now you just sit there. Listen, I'll read from the Tryst of Sir Lancelot, all right?
Yeah.
Are you listening?
Yes, go on, please.
And Ethelred, seeking entry into the hermit's house, uplifted his mace, and striking at the door, made room for his gauntleted hand. And now, pulling sturdily, he ripped it asunder, so that the noise of the dry and hollow-sounding wood reverberated through the forest.
What's the matter, Hugh? Why do you stop?
I thought I heard something.
Uh-huh.
This atmosphere must be upsetting my nerves. I'll go on. Reverberated through the forest. Now, entering the door, Ethelred saw a dragon of scaly and prodigious demeanor. And Ethelred uplifted his mace and struck the dragon, whereupon it fell with a dreadful shriek. Merciful heavens! Usher, did you hear that?
Read.
You did hear that, didn't you?
Read.
And now the champion approached the wall of the room, whereon hung a great brass shield, which in sooth tarried not for his coming, but fell at his feet with a mighty and terrible ringing sound. He was... Usher! Usher, did you hear that? Answer me, did you hear that?
Hear it? Yes, my friend. Yes, I hear it, and I have heard it long, many minutes, many hours, many days. I have heard it and dare not speak. You know why? Do you know? I'll tell you. My friend, because I have put her living into her tomb. Didn't I tell you my senses were acute? Now I will tell you that I heard her first feeble movements in her hollow coffin. I heard them 8 days ago, yes. And then I heard the rending of her coffin, the grating of the iron hinges of a prison, her poor struggles in that copper archway of the vault.
No.
And now she comes.
You're insane.
She comes, I tell you. Haven't you heard the footsteps on the stair? I tell you, this very instant, she stands outside that door.
There's no one there.
I tell you, she stands outside that door. Her hand is on that latch. Don't you see her? Turn that latch. What? Sister. Beloved. Madeline.
For a moment she stood, trembling and reeling to and fro upon the threshold, blood upon her white robes, and then, with a low, moaning cry, she fell upon her brother and bore him to his death at my very feet. From that mansion I fled aghast. The storm was at its fury as I crossed the bridge. I turned. The radiance of the blood-red moon was shining through the widening fissure that cracked the walls of the house from roof to base. And suddenly, there came a fierce whirlwind, and the entire orb of the moon burst into my sight. The mighty walls rushed asunder, and there was tumultuous sound like the voice of a thousand waters. And then, the deep, dank tarn at my feet closed sullenly, silently, eternally over the fragments of the House of Usher.
have been listening to Tales of Edgar Allan Poe, an NBC University Theater production starring Joseph Schildkraut. Next week at this same time, we will bring you another classic of Anglo-American literature, selections from the Pickwick Papers by Charles Dickens. The present semester of the NBC University Theater is devoted to the classics of Anglo-American literature from the time of Henry Fielding to that of Henry James. If you wish, you may learn more about these authors and their works by enrolling in the college-supervised courses now being offered in connection with the NBC University Theater. The University of Tulsa, Kansas State Teachers College, and Washington State College have now completed their plans for offering such a course in the coming months, thus joining the University of Louisville, whose established home study plan is already serving listeners in another area of the nation. For information, then, as to how you may enhance your knowledge through these courses, write to the NBC University Theater in care of the University of Louisville, Louisville, Kentucky, Washington State College, Pullman, Washington, Kansas State Teachers College, Pittsburgh, Kansas, or the University of Tulsa at Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'll repeat that. For information, write to the NBC University Theater in care of the University of Louisville, Louisville, Kentucky, Washington State College, Pullman, Washington, Kansas State Teachers College, Pittsburgh, Kansas, or the University of Tulsa at Tulsa, Oklahoma. The Tales of Edgar Allan Poe were adapted for radio by George Lefferts. Our intermission commentator was Dr. Harvey Webster. Starred was Joseph Schildkraut, internationally famed star of stage and screen, who was heard as Robert in Nosology, Montresor in The Cask of Amontillado, and Roderick Usher in The Fall of the House of Usher, which co-starred Barry Kroger. Lester Sharp was Fortunato in The Cask of Amontillado. Our cast included Stanley Waxman, Georgia Backus, Stephen Chase, Miriam Jay, Don Diamond, Parley Bear, Tony Barrett, Shep Mencken, Jack Crucian, Margaret Brayton, Lynn Allen. Your announcer, Don Stanley. The original musical score was composed and conducted by Dr. Albert Harris. The director of the University Theater is Andrew C. Love. Next week, be with us again for the NBC University Theater dramatization of The Pickwick Papers by Charles Dickens, starring Edmund Gwenn as Mr. Pickwick. Today's NBC University Theater production of The Tales of Edgar Allan Poe came to you from Hollywood's Radio City. This is NBC, the national broadcasting company.
On the RTC Weekly Download, we provide you with about 90 minutes of great old-time radio every week. But you know something? There's a place where you can hear it 24/7, 365. That's pretty much all the time, folks, at www.oldtimeradiolisten.com. So go to that address, oldtimeradiolisten.com, and click on the stream button there, and you can listen to old-time radio anytime you want. But don't forget us. We're back with some of the best of the stuff right here every week, so we want you here, too. As promised, we have Hollywood Star Time now, with Vincent Price as the star of Calculated Risk from 1951.
Now, Mr. Vincent Price on the Bromo Seltzer Hollywood Star Playhouse. Bromo Seltzer presents Hollywood Star Playhouse, tales of suspense, thrills, adventure by Hollywood's finest writers with Hollywood's top stars. Portions of this program are transcribed and is brought to you by Bromo Seltzer, the fast, effective headache help which reminds you to
fight!
evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Herbert Rawlinson. Welcome to the Bromo Seltzer Hollywood Star Playhouse. Crime paid, and paid exceedingly well for Bart Willard. But he was no ordinary crook. He was a virtuoso. Tonight, Mr. Vincent Price will take you on an amazing adventure in crime as he portrays for you the incomparable Bart Willard in Calculated Risk.
When a general sets out to win a war, he has to take certain chances, what he calls calculated risks. It's the same with a man who sets out to steal $1 million on his wedding day.
Willard, you're kidding.
Am I?
Hold up the Hyperion payroll service? Why, it's never been done.
It's never been tried.
Yeah, and you know why. That place is built like a fort. It'd take an army to get inside.
It will take two men, Ames. Reading from left to right, us.
You and me hold up the Hyperion payroll service? You've been bumped on the head lately?
I never get bumped on the head or anywhere else. Because I use my head to plan things. Plan them so carefully, so thoroughly, so accurately, that I've never yet pulled a job that ended in complications.
Yeah, but a job like this...
Then your answer is no?
Well, how'd you ever happen to pick me out, Willard?
Because you're an A1 electrician.
What's my being an electrician got to do with it?
I don't think we ought to go into that, unless and until you make up your mind that you want in on the $1 million.
Million? Even a Hyperion never has that much on hand.
It will have on the 31st. A nice round million in cash.
$1 million smackers. What kind of split?
Well, when a man is dividing $1 million, he can afford to be generous. How about 50-50?
500,000. It's crazy, Willard. Craziest thing I ever heard of. But you might get away with it.
What do you mean, might?
Okay, count me in.
Good. Now then, Ames, you're never to come to see me. You're never to so much as call me. I'll contact you at my own discretion. You got that?
Hey, wait a minute.
Yes?
You haven't told me yet why you need an electrician.
Why, to set off the burglar alarm at the Hyperion payroll service.
To set off the... What?
I had led Ames to believe that he was the only other person necessary to my plan. Technically, this was not correct. There were others who were destined to play an important part, particularly the woman I loved.
Hi, am I late?
Aren't you always? Karen, I believe you'd be late at your own wedding.
Is that a proposal?
It is.
Well, stop the car, you oaf, so I can accept. And I will not be late at my own wedding.
Oh, yes, you will, but you're worth waiting for.
Bart, you say the nicest.
I'm the nicest guy. But I shouldn't be blocking traffic.
Got a cigarette?
Yeah, you know I don't smoke.
You know I do.
Yes, and I also know that you're always out of cigarettes. Here.
You're going to make a perfect husband, Bart. Light?
You could at least bring matches. Press that knob.
Oh. How long does it take?
For the car lighter?
No, silly, to get a license.
3 days. Here's your light.
Thanks. We could go to Yuma.
Karen, my sweet, we're not getting married until the 31st.
Hey, that's a whole week off.
It has to be the 31st, Karen, for sentimental reasons.
Oh. Well, we'll make it a morning wedding. I always say...
No, Karen, an afternoon wedding. 4 o'clock on the afternoon of the 31st.
For sentimental reasons?
Yes. 1 million of them. I didn't really intend for the wedding ceremony to be held at 4 o'clock on the afternoon of the 31st. 4 o'clock was when I would be robbing the Hyperion payroll service of $1 million. That seeming discrepancy was one of my calculated risks. Just one of them.
Hi,
I don't know. Well, the more I think...
You're not supposed to think, Ames. That's my function.
Yeah, I know. I know. But the more I... Well, at least we ought to have a few others in with us, eh?
And that would only make the risk larger and the split smaller.
But couldn't we have one more?
Meaning Eddie Cole?
Yeah. Eddie's pulled some big jobs, and now that he's out of stir again...
Yeah, he'll be the number one suspect.
What?
Ames, when a man who has pulled some big jobs returns to the scene of his operations, the police are bound to think of him first when a project like ours unfolds.
Hey, that's right. We better forget about Eddie.
Not entirely.
What do you mean by that?
Ames, you're simply going to have to leave details to me. Now, let's review the modus operandi. Hmm?
Oh, you and your college education. Well... First of all, I got to set off that burglar alarm.
At precisely 3:30. Now, that part should be simple enough for you.
Yeah, that part, but what...
One point at a time. Now, after the excitement at the Hyperion Payroll Service has died down over the false alarm, a call will go out to the burglar alarm company. Result? Two electricians will be dispatched to repair the system at the Hyperion. These two electricians will be wearing overalls with the company insignia and will be carrying company identification cards.
Identification cards. I didn't even think of that.
I did. And I already have reasonable facsimiles of such cards bearing reasonable facsimiles of our faces as they will be made up for that occasion.
Makeup, eh? No way you're wearing masks?
Masks, my dear Ames, are old-fashioned, obsolete, archaic. Such techniques are for amateurs.
Well...
And for the professional, the man who makes an art of his trade, there are ways to change the... color of one's eyes, the tilt of one's nose. Don't worry, our makeup will be most effective.
Yeah, well... let's see, where were we?
With the two electricians. Now then, as they drive out of the company garage, they will be unaware of the fact that I'm hiding in the back of their panel truck. But as they cut through the park en route to the Hyperion plant, I shall reveal myself and take over.
Well, what are you going to do with them two?
Don't be squeamish.
Oh, you don't stop at nothing, do you?
Not at anything I consider necessary. But to go on, I will pick you up at the farthest side of the park, and you will crawl into the back of the truck and put on the coveralls. We shall arrive at the Hyperion plant, be admitted into the garage entrance, and then, just as the shift changes at 4 o'clock, be welcomed into the stronghold itself.
Yeah. And what do we do then?
Why, steal the $1,000,000. I was incredibly busy during those last few days, but I managed to be seen frequently in public with Karen, and even on one occasion to join her in dining with her next of kin, Uncle John. To everyone but Karen, and now me, of course, Uncle John was known as Captain Dorsey, head of the robbery detail at police headquarters.
Well, I don't suppose it's been any secret to you, Willard, that I tried my best to put a damper on this romance.
Well, I assure you, Uncle John, I shall never let that stand between us.
Well, a man who's been under suspicion in the past and has no visible means of support in the present...
Uncle John, you are slandering the man I love, and after he's been good enough to want you with the wedding.
Yes, I know. I'm just a suspicious old... Karen, I wish I could make it at that.
Hey, what do you mean you wish you could make it? Who's going to give me away?
But an afternoon wedding. And in the middle of the week. Honey, I'm sorry.
A fine relative you turned out to be. You'd rather be out arresting people.
But, Karen, I've got a responsibility.
Well, what about your responsibility to me? Bart said it would be like this.
Oh, I did, eh?
Well, I meant to...
I know what you meant. Well, all right, Karen. I'll be there.
That's better. And before I forget, you're to stop by and take me to the chapel.
Well, why doesn't he?
Oh, you know the old taboo about the bridegroom seeing the bride before the ceremony? Yeah, but if it's too much trouble, oh, I...
Silliest thing I ever heard of, but... Well, all right.
Then I almost forgive you. Now, everything's all set.
Yes. And I'll be waiting for the two of you outside the chapel at 4 o'clock. Karen would be late, of course, and so Uncle John would have no way of knowing that I hadn't been there at the chapel waiting for them at 4 o'clock. And since Uncle John was head of the robbery detail at police headquarters, admittedly, there was the chance that Karen and her uncle wouldn't be late enough, or even late at all. But again, that was one of my calculated risks. And as of 4 o'clock on the afternoon of the 31st, I was supremely confident that all would be well. Everything, as the generals say, was proceeding according to plan.
Yeah, the other shift was wondering what happened to you guys.
Heavy traffic.
Yeah, heavy traffic.
Oh, yeah, ain't it a crime? Why, when I was coming to work...
Hey, you.
Me?
Both of you guys. You're new with the outfit, eh?
So what if we are?
Nothing. Just part of my job to ask questions.
Yeah, but we already checked our identifications. Don't mind Joe, he's okay, except he's always acting like something's gonna happen.
Well, how do you know it won't?
Look, Joe, when you've been here as many years as I
have... Well, we better get to work.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know the layout?
Oh, sure.
Hey, stop! What's the matter now? Call your office.
Oh, yeah, you're supposed to call your office. They phoned a couple of minutes ago.
Oh, we'll do it later.
They said right away. And I think you better.
Now, look, Joe, if they want to call later...
No, maybe he's right. Where's the phone I can use?
Well, that one right on the desk there.
Come to think of it, I'd rather use this.
Huh?
So I was right.
But you're wrong if you think you can do anything about it. I'm right behind you, see?
Well, you guys are nuts if you think you can get away with this.
Shut up, Joe. Don't try anything, Joe.
Good advice, Joe. Try anything and you're dead. Now then, listen carefully. Was elemental. When two men have guns in their backs, they cooperate, and so do their fellow workers. In a gratifyingly short time, the money was out of the vault, and the men assigned to guard it were in. Total elapsed time for the $1 million robbery of the Hyperion Payroll Service? 11 minutes. Not so fast, Ames. It wouldn't do to get a ticket now for speeding.
Okay, okay. You're almost done back there.
Almost.
Hey, Willard, now that the job's finished, what was that crack you made the first time we talked, you know, about Eddie Cole?
Oh, I contrived to have him off on a wild goose chase this afternoon.
What for?
Obviously so that he won't have an alibi when he's accused of the Hyperion job.
No. You don't stop at nothing, do you?
As you've remarked before. Oh. Behold, the bridegroom emerges.
Yeah, hold up for your wedding. Well, when do we divvy up?
That's a timely question. Hey, look, turn into this clump of trees.
Hey, isn't that your car parked over there?
Correct. Pull up beside it. Now, Ames, comes the final reckoning.
Yeah, 500 G's.
I'm already 18 minutes late for my wedding. I have to rush this.
Yeah, well...
Remember, Ames, my saying that the fewer who knew about this job, the greater the split and the smaller the risk?
Well, it's only... No, well... No. You wouldn't?
I don't stop at anything, remember? Sorry, Ames. It's a risk you should have calculated.
Bromo Seltzer, famous for fast, effective headache help, is bringing you Hollywood Star Playhouse. Tonight, starring Mr. Vincent Price in Calculated Risk.
Fight! Headache! Three ways! Bromo Seltzer, Bromo Seltzer, Bromo Seltzer, Bromo Seltzer.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? How do you do? This is your old friend Norman Brokenshire. You know, I wouldn't ask anybody to do anything I wouldn't do myself. That's why I'd like you to try Bromo Seltzer the next time you get a headache. I want you to find out for yourself just how fast and how effective it is in helping your headache all three ways. Yes, most headaches are caused by an upset stomach, too much stomach acidity. When this happens, your nerves become jumpy and jangled too. Well, the very second you add water to Bromo Seltzer, it fizzes and sparkles, ready to go right to work on the pain of that headache. Bromo Seltzer soothes your upset stomach by neutralizing that excess stomach acidity, and it calms those jittery, jangled nerves. That's how Bromo Seltzer does its wonderful three-way job. Try it the next time you get a headache. For best results, use cold water. Follow the label, avoid excessive use. But don't wait until a headache strikes. Get Bromo Seltzer at any drugstore. Keep it handy always. Yes, when you get a headache, remember to take
Bromazelte.
Now, Act Two of Calculated Risk, starring Mr. Vincent Price.
Putting a bullet into my associate Ames was one of the least palatable aspects of the million-dollar robbery of the Hyperion payroll service. But now that this was done, everything was taken care of. If only Karen and Uncle John were late enough for the wedding. I stopped at the first drugstore and phoned Karen's apartment. The time? 4:23. To a girl as incurably tardy as Karen, 23 minutes was nothing. Surely she couldn't have left already. Or had my repeated remarks that she'd be late for her own wedding had a reverse psychology? Or had Uncle John, the ever punctual Captain Dorsey, head of the police robbery detail, managed by some irony of fate to get her off to the wedding on time? As I drove up, they weren't waiting outside the chapel, nor was Uncle John's car in the lot reserved for wedding parties. It could only mean that they had given up waiting for me, probably been calling my apartment from 4 o'clock on, and then left with Karen in tears and Uncle John in high dudgeon. Now I was totally devoid of any kind of alibi. And as soon as Uncle John delved into the Hyperion, hold up. I was inside the chapel, about to press the little bell that would summon the minister from the rectory, when panic seized me. What was I waiting for? The $1 million was in the luggage compartment of my car. The thing to do was jump into that car and head for a hideout. Yes, that was it.
Bart Willard.
Karen.
Where do you think you're going?
Well, I
how many times have you told me I'd be late for my wedding? Well, I just couldn't start our marriage off by making you out a liar.
But I called your apartment and no one answered. Something happened on the way?
Certainly did. You know Karen. As if it wasn't bad enough that we were late getting started, what does she do but run out of cigarettes?
Of course.
And by the time I parked, went into a drugstore...
You knew I was this way when you fell in love with me, Bart. Now, don't tell me you'd want to change me.
My sweet, not for $1 million. It wasn't until the ceremony was over and I had given Uncle John $100 of the Hyperion payroll service's money with which to pay the minister that the call for him finally came. My bride and I waited outside for Uncle John to rejoin us.
Oh, wouldn't you know it? Wouldn't you know it would happen on one afternoon I take off?
Something wrong?
Wrong. Wait till the papers get hold of this.
Uncle John, what's happened?
$1 million robbery, that's what, in broad daylight.
Oh, no, where?
I think all I've got to do is stand here and... Oh, where's my car?
Good luck, Uncle John.
Yeah, good luck.
Well, look you up the first day we're back from our honeymoon.
Speaking of honeymoons, Mrs. Willard.
Mrs. Willard. Oh, darling, isn't everything perfect?
My sentiments, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Willard, stop kissing my niece and open the luggage compartment of your car.
Huh?
You heard me. Open the luggage compartment of your car.
But, Uncle John, I...
Stop calling me Uncle John. I'm Captain Dorsey of the robbery detail, and don't you forget it.
I assure you I haven't for a moment.
Well, are you going to open the luggage compartment of your car?
Uncle John, you're being simply awful. All you have to do is tell Bart why.
I've got a flat tire, that's why, and my tire jack is broken.
Captain... The most amazing coincidence, my tire jack won't work either.
Oh, no.
Why don't you just hop into a cab?
Cab, nothing. I'm taking your car.
Viewing it objectively, the situation was almost amusing. Here was Captain Dorsey roaring off to investigate a $1 million robbery... And in the luggage compartment of the car he was driving reposed the $1 million. But I confess I wasn't enjoying the joke as of the moment. I was far too intent on getting the captain's tire fixed and then returning his car to him so that I could retrieve my own.
What is this place, Bob?
Oh, you know, the outfit that was robbed. Hyperion Payroll Service, I think they call it. They said at headquarters we'd find Uncle John here.
Oh, look, there's your car.
Yeah, yeah. Now, why don't you run inside and give Uncle John his keys and get mine, huh?
I'm going to get even with Uncle John for being such a meanie on my wedding day. You go.
Look, my sweet, they're investigating a holdup in there. If I were to walk inside, well, they might start asking me questions.
You mean before you were able to explain you only came to trade keys with Uncle John?
Yes.
Wouldn't that be a laugh? Especially if someone thought he recognized you as one of the holdup men. Those things happen sometimes, you know.
Yes, I know.
I'm almost tempted.
Except, of course, that it might affect our honeymoon.
Hey, that's different. You give me those keys.
Here you are.
I'll be right back.
Uh-oh.
What?
Look who's coming.
Uncle John.
Oh, you barely caught me. About to leave for headquarters with this fellow.
Hello, Willard.
Do I know you?
Name is Cove. Eddie Cove.
Cove? No, that doesn't ring any bell.
Not even a burglar alarm?
Uncle John, who is this person?
Our number one suspect, that's who.
That's what you say.
You've got nothing to say because you've got no alibi.
If you ask me, Uncle John, he doesn't look smart enough to steal all that money.
Hey, you hear that, Captain? Now, Willard, he looks smart enough.
We're wasting time. Where are those keys?
Here you are, darling.
Thanks for the use of your car, Willard. Sorry I chewed your ears off.
Quite all right, Uncle John. Coming wise?
Let's go, husband.
Oh, see, you fool. Don't let him get away. He pulled the job and framed me for it. Yeah, it all adds up.
Look, Cole.
He's one of the shrewdest operators on the loose, I tell you. Ask him where he was at 4 o'clock this afternoon.
The captain doesn't have to ask me. He knows I was at the chapel waiting to get married.
Oh, yeah?
So there.
As for your reflections on my character, they can only be dismissed as preposterous. Since this is my wedding day, I even find it in my heart to forgive you. You did say your name was Cove?
Captain Dorsey.
Well, Sergeant?
They found the other guy.
What other guy?
They pulled the job. Ames, remember him?
Where?
In the park with a bullet in him. But he's still breathing.
How could I have been so incredibly stupid as to rush off without making sure that Ames was dead? Yes, and now what if he came to long enough to speak my name? This assuredly had not been one of my calculated risks. Again, panic boiled up within me. And as my bride and I drove away to start our honeymoon, it was all I could do to keep from jamming my foot down on the accelerator.
Know something, husband?
Huh?
You are going to get a ticket if you don't slow down.
Oh.
Know something else, husband? I have the distinct impression that I am talking to myself.
Oh, I'm sorry. What?
Cigarettes, I said. Over.
What about cigarettes?
The usual.
Oh, but you can't be out. Uncle John bought you a pack.
I left him his car, I guess.
Oh, Karen.
You mean you forgot to bring me some?
Look, I'll get them later.
Why want them now?
Please, Karen.
Well, all you have to do is stop someplace.
But I don't want to stop.
Oh? So that's the way it is.
What's the way what is?
Just because we're married.
Karen, you don't understand.
Well, don't I? Then quit acting as if I was suddenly farthest from your thoughts.
All right. First chance I get.
There, that drugstore on the corner. Well?
It was as I was coming out of the drugstore with a carton of cigarettes under my arm that I saw the police car. It pulled up to the curb. Two officers got out. Faintly, I could hear their two-way radio. It wasn't hard for me to imagine what it was saying. Ames had talked. So it was all over now, unless... That's when I started shooting.
Bart!
The only way, Karen, the only way.
Look out!
Uncle John, that's the whole story.
No, Willard, not the whole story.
You mean about Karen? What?
Can't you guess?
No.
And another thing. You didn't calculate the biggest risk of all, the risk of losing your head.
Oh?
That radio car. The only reason it stopped was because you were in a no parking zone.
Then, but Ames...
He died without ever regaining consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Vincent?
Now, wait a minute, Herb. Before you start telling me I was terrific, just remember that a play's only as good as its cast. I'm talking about Betty Lou Gerson, Ted Von Eltz, Ed Max, Byron Kane, and Jerry Hausner. Thanks, fellas.
Thank you, Vincent. In just a moment, I'm going to introduce Mr. Wendell Corey, the star of next week's play. And now, here is Norman Brokenshire.
Thank you, Herb. An exciting story. You know, neighbors, when you're sniffling and sneezing with one of those nasty colds, and a headache teams up with that cold, you can really be miserable. Well, when that happens to you, just reach for that familiar blue bottle of Bromo Seltzer. Refreshing Bromo Seltzer helps the pain of your headache in short order. And when you've helped your headache, it's a lot easier to face anything else you're up against. The proper rest and following your doctor's advice will take care of that cold. That's why these wintry days, Bromo Seltzer is such a friend in need to smart people everywhere. That's why thousands are turning to Bromo Seltzer for headache help. It fights a headache fast and effectively these three ways. Bromo Seltzer gives you speedy help for the headache pain itself. Bromo Seltzer soothes your upset stomach by neutralizing excess stomach acidity, and it calms those jittery, jangled nerves. As for speed, just compare the amazing speed of Bromo Seltzer's effervescence with that of any product in tablet form you've ever tried. So remember, when you've got a cold, don't let headache pain add to your misery. Get fast, effective help for your headache with Bromo Seltzer. Yes.
Fight headache three ways. Bromo Seltzer, Bromo Seltzer, Bromo Seltzer, Bromo Seltzer.
Vincent Price can soon be seen co-starring with Jane Russell and Robert Mitchum in the RKO production, His Kind of Woman. Tonight's play was written especially for Mr. Price by Maurice Zim, with music composed and conducted by Jeff Alexander. The entire production is under the direction of Jack Johnstone. And now here is the star of next week's thrilling story on Hollywood Star Playhouse, Mr. Wendell Corey.
I'm not a killer, Herb. I never have been, I swear it. But listen, from the minute they found the body, I didn't have a chance. Because they knew that I not only had time to kill, but I had time to kill.
Time to kill sounds like a honey for next week, Wendell. Thank you. On tonight's program, all characters and incidents were fictitious. Any similarity to actual characters or incidents is purely coincidental. Portions of this program were transcribed. And now this is Herbert Rawlinson saying goodnight for all of us here on the Hollywood Star Playhouse. And for Bromo Seltzer, the fast, effective headache help in the familiar blue bottle. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Well, that's it for this week. We'll be back next week, so I hope you'll be here with us to listen to more great old-time radio. Till then, this is